The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Gabe Keller, and I work at the center, and I sub for Mark while he's gone. He's just getting back from retreat today and visiting his mother-in-law for a week, and then he'll be back starting a lot of new programs like the intro class and a community practice intensive for people who want to do more formal practice and connect more with the community. That'll be a good opportunity for that. So the title of the talk tonight is Beyond Coping, Uncovering Real Happiness and Peace. And it's something I've been thinking about for my last talk I gave at the half-day retreat. I was looking at this book, Awakening Joy by James Beres, which I'm hoping to read. I was just skimming through it, but found it really useful. Part of the intention with the talk tonight is to inspire us. Happiness. So, and then this part of beyond coping was something I've also been reflecting on, just our intentions with practice and why we practice, why we come to meditation practice, and for a lot of us, I know for me, it is about coping with what's difficult. And that's good. I mean, it's great that we have these tools that work for that, at least somewhat. But it was interesting to reflect on it. You know, is that my deepest aspiration? Is that why I meditate? And sometimes it is. So it's not to judge that, but just to really recognize what we're doing when we're meditating and how that changes in different times. And I think also a part of it that I'm recognizing more is when I'm using meditation to cope, but it might not actually be what's most useful in that moment. So there can be this blind faith at times, or spiritual idealism, where we have a lot of faith in our meditation practice. But we have the mindset, we have a fixed view that if I just meditate every day, and the more I meditate every day, the better, the faster I'll get to wherever it is that I want to go. And the part that's good to recognize in that, because on one level that's probably true, just the more we come to Dharma talks and go on retreats and sit, if we're doing our best, it's good to develop that habit, and it's a good habit to have, but we want to recognize if it is a habit and if we are clinging to it in any way, because there's a story in there that we might not be recognizing, which Ajahn Sumedho, a great teacher, one of my favorite teachers, talks about quite a lot. This unquestioned assumption that I'm somebody unenlightened who has to practice really hard and then I'll get enlightened. And it's not that that's, you know, it's not trying to decide whether that's true or not, but it's to see that actually being active in the mind, really believing that, and that there's suffering in that because I'm not enlightened yet. So it's inherent in that. So it can reinforce this. I mean, I'm really talking from personal experience. Like, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of meditating and getting really frustrated and just there being a lot of striving that, like, I know I'm not happy now, and I'm meditating and it's not working, not feeling any better. And yeah. And then at a certain point, I just stop. And sometimes it's that moment of stopping and realizing, you know, whatever I'm doing, it's not working. And then to just have to get up and go on with my day. Sometimes those moments right after in that transition, because in that transition, there's like, there can be this death of the assumption that this was going to really help, but it didn't. And but then the wisdom can come in that moment. Oh, it didn't work for a reason. It didn't work because I was trying really hard to control the mind or, you know, suppress things. So in some ways we have to let the practice do us. And we're always going to be trying to manipulate and come at the practice from a self-centered point of view because that's our only reference point. So we're kind of have to keep sometimes banging our head against the wall. But then what happens, hopefully, is we have some compassion for this small self, like, you know, just desperately wanting peace, but not, even when we're sitting, not knowing how to do it, how to access it, because we're clinging to it. And this is kind of the theme of the talk, is that actually happiness, there's a quote I think from Ajahn Brahm, you don't meditate to be happy and then you'll be able to meditate better. So it's kind of the theme of the talk is moving from this is from Ajahn Munindo. I was also looking at this book, Unexpected Freedom. He talks about a source-oriented practice versus a goal-oriented practice, and I liked that. So that it's not always, it's so painful to be in that mindset of, I'm not good enough, but if I meditate enough, maybe I'll be better. So when we see this, it starts to break our heart, and it starts to exhaust us. So those are sort of the moments I was describing sometimes at the end of my meditation where it's like, this isn't working. And that's just a good thing to keep your eye out for if we're doing the same thing and it's not working. A more wisdom-oriented practice where it's really, we know that we don't know what to do. And that's a great starting point. So we try something else, like surrendering, being vulnerable, being receptive, these words that we use in meditation instructions that are pointing to another way of being. And then sometimes we have moments where there's more of a flow, and then we cling to those. And then we're the person that's got it. And now we know how to just be vulnerable and let go. But still, there's someone who wants to let go. So I really think this is inevitable. It's just what happens. But it's just good to recognize. And I think in those moments when we're striving really hard in meditation, we're not really connected to our deepest aspiration. Maybe we think the goal of meditation this morning, because I woke up feeling anxious, for example, the goal of this meditation is to feel calm. But is that our deepest aspiration, to feel calm all the time? To have no unpleasant emotions, no, never get angry, just be completely unruffled. That, yeah, that doesn't sound that possible. I mean, we have those ideals, like the Buddha, but we want to just see how we're holding that. Are we holding that as an ideal, as something to impersonate? But it's always, yeah, it's not about pretending. At least for me, that doesn't feel like my deepest aspiration. So it can be hard to put words to our deepest aspiration. And in some ways, I think it's good to be careful, because it's our deepest aspiration, and it can almost feel like cheapening it to say it out loud, because it's so deep. And so there's an interesting paradox or point in the Buddha's teachings where he talked somewhat about the goal of practice, about what he saw as our deepest aspiration, the complete unbinding of the heart, Nibbana. But he didn't spend a lot of time talking about it, creating a beautiful picture of it. You know, this is the goal, because he understood how easy it is for us to strive towards some ideal. But I think we do need to be inspired, and our practice should be motivated by our deepest aspiration, however we phrase that. So the Buddha didn't talk a lot about Nibbana, which is the word for, means cessation, but the word for the goal, the traditional goal of Buddhist practice. But he did talk somewhat about it, and this is a great book if you're interested in Nibbana. It's called The Island, and it's a compilation of teachings that the Buddha gave on Nibbana. So it explores a lot this, how do we hold the goal, the aspiration. So the Buddha did offer some synonyms for Nibbana: the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the everlasting, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the blessed, safety, the wonderful, the marvelous, Nibbana, purity, freedom, the island, the refuge, the beyond. And in the community room, we have a little hanging thing with a lot of the synonyms for Nibbana that you can read on there. There's a song that my girlfriend's choir sings called Deep Peace. It's a really beautiful song, and it comes from a Gaelic blessing. But I thought of that when I was thinking of my deepest aspiration. Deep Peace. And sometimes deep peace doesn't sound that appealing, so we can look at that too. I've heard it said that the different Buddhist personality types have different relationships to peace. Like for me, peace sounds great, the deep peace. I'm an aversive type. So just that, for the mind to be quiet and not be critical and just rest. But for a desire type, peace might not sound that interesting. They might be more... other words might be more appealing. But in any case, however we define our deepest aspiration, we want to see how often are we really touching into that? What's our relationship to that? Maybe it doesn't feel like it's within reach. A lot of times it doesn't. our deepest aspiration, complete freedom, deep peace. How often during the course of the day is that sort of what we're trying to intuit, trying to relax into? And then we see what's in the way of that. But I think it's good to recognize that we do have a deep aspiration. And that's sort of our compass, or like a song that's calling to us all throughout our lives at different times. We hear it, and sometimes it's really clear, and we really taste its reality. And then for a lot of the time, it's just a memory. But the Buddha, I think, said, or somebody said, like, once you have a taste of freedom, peace, even if it's just the first time you meditate and there's just a sense, oh, like, this mind can really settle, then we usually don't stop. Maybe we stop and start, but this is a wholesome kind of desire, a wholesome kind of pleasantness. So there's an interesting part in this book, The Island, where Ajahn Sumedho, who's probably the most senior Western monk in the Thai forest tradition, he trained under Ajahn Chah, who's a great Thai forest master. But he talks about why in the West he emphasized this teaching on Nibbana more. And I thought it was really interesting what he said. He said, "After teaching in the West for a very short period of time, I began to see that many people were disappointed both in materialism and theistic religions. To them, Buddhism had great appeal, but lacking any fundamental sense of or faith in the transcendent, the practice of Buddhism became almost a dry, technical procedure, intellectually satisfying but strangely sterile as well. They had largely rejected the idea of an ultimate reality from their thoughts as being intrinsically theistic nonsense. So I realized that people needed to be aware that there was also such a principle in the Buddha's teachings, without there being any hint of a creator God in the picture. In Thailand, because there is already such a broad and strong basis of faith in these transcendent qualities, there's no need to talk about ultimate reality, the unconditioned, and so forth. For them, it can be a distraction. Here, I saw that people needed something to look up to. That's why I talk about it all the time. It goes a long way to cultivating faith, and it gives a much more living and expansive quality to their spiritual life. There is a natural joy when the heart opens to its true nature." So I appreciated that. I recognized that in myself, that what made Buddhism so appealing initially was that it made so much sense and had a system and was logical. But when I look at what's really been inspiring in my practice, it's been those moments of freedom with, you know, not ultimate freedom, but just along the way freedom. And to really recognize that that's what that is. It's a moment. In the suttas, they talk about momentary nibbana. So it's a moment. There's another definition of nibbana. "Having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is nibbana, I tell you, the total aging of the total ending of aging and death." So having nothing, clinging to nothing. So I think another interesting point is where this intersects with the messiness of life, because I think that's why the Buddha was careful to not talk too much about the unconditioned, while it's really useful to have a sense that there's something really beautiful, you know, it's what's inspiring. And we can see that in different ways. For some people, it'll be really connecting to just the goodness of the heart and the beautiful qualities of the heart and how that takes them out of themselves. For others, it will be just those moments where things are really simple and all the dramas aren't active. And there's just that taste, oh, this is what it's like when the mind isn't creating drama. And then we inhabit that more. But it's such an inspiring idea that we can get attached to it. And there's a quote from Nagarjuna, who is an Indian writer. This was more, I think, in the 13th century, around then, so a while after the Buddha. But he said, "Believers in emptiness are incurable." So you can get attached to the notion of non-attachment. And then we have this new term of spiritual bypassing, thinking that since everything's empty, since everything's okay, since there's the island, when we're clinging to that as a notion, or just even the notion that I'm somebody unenlightened and if I practice enough, I'll be enlightened. So, but it's about caring. It's about opening to the way it is. So if the way it is that it's really hard, then I think Shelley said this once in one of her talks, that one of her teachers told her on retreat that, you know, Shelley was saying something like, well, I know it's, you know, I'm feeling this unpleasant emotion and I just have to be with it. But her teacher said, you know, like, just care, just open to it. So even just the language we use, it can be right but not true, true but not right, as Ajahn Chah said. So how do we have faith to keep going, but without it being blind faith or it being dogmatic? So I think it has to come from our own experience. And this is where it's hard, because we start as really deluded people. So we don't. But we have to start where we are. Rodney Smith, a teacher in Seattle, I was on retreat with him when I did a long retreat, an 8-month retreat after college. And he said, do what you know. Like, it's not enough to have moments of intuiting freedom, intuiting love. We actually have to reinforce those, like even on a neurological level, like that's how things, we get familiar with things, is by doing them over and over again and really paying attention. But we only know what we know. So I think the way it works is we've all had some moments of peace and freedom from the practice that we associate with the practice, maybe while sitting or after sitting for years, we just notice that there's more freedom or peace. So we figure we should keep doing it because there's probably more to come. But when it actually, but mostly we're actually groping in the dark about how to actually, in the moment-to-moment debate, basis, move forward. But I think that's actually a good place to start, is when we're honest that we actually have no idea what to do, what the right thing to do is. Because it's only then that we're actually willing to show up with our experience and learn from it. We could have a PhD in Buddhism, PhD in non-clinging, but it's a different kind of learning. And again, in this book, Awakening Joy, which I really like, just the little I've read of it, but I'll read you a little bit from a neuroscientist, Rick Hansen, who wrote a book called Buddha's Brain, which I also haven't read, but anyways, this is from that. And he's talking about positive experiences and how our brains are conditioned to register negative experiences because that's more advantageous evolutionarily to really focus on the negative experiences. He says, a single bad event with a dog stands out more vividly than 1,000 good ones. In other words, the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences and like Teflon for positive ones. The amygdala, a little almond-shaped bunch of neurons in the center of the brain, plays a big role in storing emotional memories, and it's primed to look for bad news. Because we're set up in this way, we can go through life doing the things that confirm our worst fears. We look for what's negative in a situation just in case it's a survival threat. Because our brain is set up to be wary, we have to help ourselves towards happiness by inclining our attention to positive experiences by consciously intending to do so. Through conscious attention, you can gradually build up a storehouse of positive experiences to neutralize the negative ones. The most powerful method I know is to deliberately look for positive experiences and take them in by being present with them. This helps the brain register the positive experiences long enough for those neurons that are firing together positively to start wiring together. I like that he was emphasizing it's not enough to just have pleasant experiences because we're having pleasant experiences all the time, even on the most miserable day, there's some pleasant experiences, but we actually need to pay attention to them with mindfulness to really let them in because we're primed to focus on what's negative. And I see this more generally just as how we do what we know, how we integrate what we're learning in our practice, that we need to soak it in, embody it. We need to trust our actual lived learning. This is what actually builds faith. Isn't we get some faith from what we read, but when we actually have moments where we see the mind letting go, the mind opening, even though it feels afraid, trusting, connecting. And then it's not enough to just have a moment, because that's sometimes, I know, what I've done, what I do, is we have a moment of letting go. Okay, now I know how to let go. But it's like we're changing the wiring, and there's so much momentum and allegiance to our assumptions, our habits about ourselves, that we really need to embody it, kind of like what we were doing with the metta practice, like let it fill completely the space of the mind and body so we really know, oh, this is what happiness, this is what peace feels like. And then any part that isn't included, we notice that, see what's in the way. And what's in the way is usually our thoughts and assumptions and beliefs about ourselves, about the world, unquestioned assumptions, long-standing assumptions that I'm bad, not good enough, can't be happy, can't connect, there's always more. But that's an assumption, and the only way that those assumptions will be challenged is by really letting in and feeling, you know, a moment of real happiness and peace and connection, because that challenges that, and that trusting that our own lived experience, we actually seems have to really practice that, really let that in till it just, the evidence overwhelms those assumptions. And I think there's been research on beliefs and assumptions that they're so strong that they don't change just because there's evidence to the contrary. Like the Bertha movement with Obama, where people were convinced that he wasn't born in the U.S., even though it was his birth certificate and all this stuff. So beliefs are really strong. And even, like, it's not enough to just see it once. Oh, I am worthy of love. Okay. No, because that's a deep habit. It seems like recently the process of awakening seems to be a process of embodiment. Like, just more and more here, more and more in the body. Because whenever I'm not in my body, it's because things are too difficult and I'm not here. But those are moments of not learning. And also because the body doesn't lie. Like, I can tell myself I'm bad, but then the body gets really tense. And so then I might think that it's true that I'm bad because my body's tense. But actually, my body's tense because I'm telling myself a really painful story. So, but we'd rather, just the momentum, it's not that we'd rather, but we believe that instead of trusting, oh, this hurts, Can I allow it to soften, to move? It's like sometimes, I don't know, I think a lot, and so I can get really caught up in doubt and things. So so lately it's sort of just been like, what actually feels good? Like, it's so simple. Does worrying feel good? No. But there's just so much habit, and yeah. It's like trusting what feels good, trusting happiness, trusting because it's kind of foreign actually for the mind to put down its worries, its obsessions, its plans, and have a moment of just happiness, of peace. We can feel kind of naked without our dramas. But we're just putting down suffering. We're just putting down clinging. The personality is still there. And we have this deep yearning, at least I do, for complete freedom, complete connection, love, happiness, peace. So even though sometimes when I have moments, and more just recently, there's just been more joy, maybe because I'm in a new relationship. And so it's like, I see like there's actually resistance to happiness, which is like the most crazy thing. Like, there's something scary about being free, even though it's our deepest wish, being happy. But there's no avoiding what's difficult. But happiness and really recognizing that it's an essential part of the path really helps us in being able to meet what's difficult, so that it's not the whole of our practice. Like, this book is so simple. It's just basically from the introduction, noticing, just noticing. There's, like, after I was reading this, preparing for my half-day talk, just noticing the mind getting caught up and worrying. And even though that's happening, after, you know, having read that, I was outside and I could notice the sun. But it seems too simple, you know. Like, can it really be useful? Can it actually be useful to notice? But it is, and it's not useful because it's the truth. Like, everything's great, and my thoughts about my real thoughts that are actually might have some wisdom to them about noticing, you know, different things that aren't going well. It's not that that's not true on some level, but it's just what it's balancing. Because at least my mind can get really fixated on what's not going well, but that's missing the other half. And even more than that, it's just not a wholesome place for the mind to dwell. But there's no sidestepping anything, I think. So we don't have to really worry about spiritual bypassing, I think, because I don't think it's really possible if you're really practicing opening to what's here. It'll keep waiting for you until you can meet it, whatever it is, the deepest fear. And it can really feel impossible, especially long-standing things that keep coming back, which is, again, where it's really useful to have a wide view and that it's not the whole picture. There's always something we can recognize, even if it's just that we care. Like Rebecca Bradshaw says, when mindfulness doesn't work, try compassion. And so this noticing joy is one way we could talk about just cultivating a good heart, cultivating beautiful qualities, not even just cultivating, but recognizing the beautiful qualities that are already present. And in this tradition, we call them paramis, and Mark's been talking about them the last few months. In the traditional list of 10, it's kindness, generosity, patience, energy, wisdom, resolve, ethical conduct, renunciation, truthfulness, and equanimity. So we really need these qualities. And traditionally, they'll say that someone's ripeness for awakening is based on the strength of their paramis. And I think it's safe to say we all have a lot of parami to be here on a beautiful Sunday night, and to be interested in these teachings and to be practicing them, to be developing them. And that it's the strength of these paramis that's really what carries us, what supports us, what gets us through hard times. It's not our capacity to bear with, you know, just force our way through, but there's a lot to open to, and so we need these. And Joseph Goldstein calls them grace. It's like the Buddhist kind of grace, these beautiful qualities that we can recognize. And I also thought we could talk about them as blessing our life. Our life becomes blessed. Sometimes when I'm more sensitive and grounded, I can really appreciate how blessed my life is to be working at a meditation center, living in a community house with really great, kind people, and then to have these qualities and to recognize them. And so then our practice isn't so much about a goal, about becoming enlightened, becoming perfect, becoming somebody else, but we're realizing, recognizing real happiness and peace here and now. And it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of difficulty. I struggle a lot with different things, anxiety, depression at different times. And yeah, so, but also there's more happiness and real happiness and real peace than probably ever. So it's, and it's not like one is based on the other being destroyed. It's really, they're like yin and yang. It's all, I think I have this down here, but it's all different expressions of the same energy. It's all just here and now. And some of it's tangled. It's like the same one energy, and part of it gets tangled up and thinks it's its own thing and is separate. Like I think Thich Nhat Hanh says, a wave thinks it's separate from the ocean. So we have these different parts. But really seeing the practice as cultivating, part of the practice is really cultivating these paramis, this happiness that can inspire us to keep pushing, to keep doing what we know. You know, we've all had moments where we see this pattern isn't useful. And so this gives us the strength. I trust in my own goodness. I can do what I know again right now. Releasing dependence on anything we cling to with fear or greed. And realizing and more deeply embodying and integrating all parts of our experience. And then we can be curious about what isn't included. Joseph Goldstein, who's one of our grandfather teachers, said when I was on retreat with him too on that long retreat that he's happy now whenever he sees an unwholesome quality in his mind, because he'd rather see it than not see it. So we can have almost a playful attitude. We can have a playful attitude when we're more in touch with the blessings, with the other side. And that's something that we can cultivate. So I'll just end with a few suggestions of some practices. One is from a sign near Sprout House where I live that I think is still there. It's ASAP, as sensitive as possible. And along with that is a mantra that I use to help me get out of my head, which is to just feel. It seems like that's sometimes the only practice instruction I would need, because so much of what causes suffering for me is trying to avoid feeling what certain feelings. And I think it was the TED Talk on vulnerability by Brené, where she says you can't just numb unpleasant feelings. When you numb unpleasant feelings, you numb all feelings. Trusting the body, And then doing what you know, however that instruction may make sense to you, that, yeah, and that whole soaking, like that's what I've been trying to do recently, is when I notice there's even just the tiniest sliver of peace or contentedness, just enjoying the sun or feeling some connection, instead of dismissing that or, you know, just noticing for a second or and then going back to worrying, it's like, oh, this is really beautiful, and it's not actually dangerous or in any way wrong. It's actually really useful to more deeply let it sink in, let it permeate.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.